distant, but it was also nice. It was a caring touch. And for some reason that was beyond him, utterly beyond him in that moment, it made Walter want to cry. He was as confused as he was sick. "I don't know what's wrong with me," he finally muttered between spitting bitterness out of his mouth. "What the fuck?" he murmured, except it wasn't really a question. "What the fuck?" Walter sat there for a time because sitting there with his head hung between his knees, staring at his own vomit seemed like the best thing to do. When his breathing leveled out, he felt better, although his heart was still going hard, and his hands shook even worse. His whole body was trembling, actually. He wiped the sweat off his face, wiped his hand on his pants, which were still dirty and scraped up. He could use a shower. A shower would be great. Some hot water, some privacy, a small, enclosed space. He thought about just sitting down on the floor of the shower and letting the hot water run over him and keeping his eyes closed for a long time and his ears covered so that the sound of the water pattering against his skull would be a steady, monotonous drum, like rain on a tin roof. That's what he needed. He stood up on unsteady knees and looked down at his mess. "Guess I should clean this up." Getty rose with Walter and he started heading for a small hose attached to a bib just off the patio. "Why don't you go inside, Walt?" he said. "I'll clean this up." Walter thought about insisting that he clean up his own mess, but honestly, escaping to the shower felt almost imperative at that moment, like he might start breaking down again if he didn't. Maybe that's what he feared more than someone else cleaning up his mess, breaking apart right in front of their eyes. "You're already breaking apart." Walter cleared his throat. "I think I'm gonna take a shower." "That's probably a good idea," Getty said, unwinding the hose from its cradle. "Thanks for that." Walter nodded to the man without making eye contact. That cigarette. He trailed off. "Guess it hit me hard." Getty bent to turn on the hose bib, then stood up. "Yeah," he said. "That'll happen occasionally." But both of them knew that neither of them believed it. Carolyn stood in the dim blue glow of a monitor, stood with her hands clasped together in front of her. She tried to stand loosely as though she was not tense all up and down her spine. She tried not to show the strain and the tightness of her face. On the monitor, a live feed of her parents. Somewhere far south of her, Benjamin and Jean Udy sat in their office-turned-command bunker in the hotel that they quietly owned in the middle of hostile territory, sitting there underneath it all, planning the fall of it, planning the invasion of Coax County. If only they could get the Coax to commit to Durham. Benjamin Udy, it was difficult for Carolyn to think of him as father now, leaned on a single elbow and rubbed the gray bristles of his beard. Beside him, Jean Udy sat paralyzed in her wheelchair, her face not showing much except for a look of pensive concentration. These images hanging in the air in front of Carolyn. She shifted her weight on her feet.
"Mother? Father?"
She had to force herself to say the words with feeling.
"This is the best chance we've got."
Benjamin let out a long breath. "Yes, it seems good." Jean remained silent. Her lips worked, but that was all. Carolyn pressed on.
"The Coax is not committing to Durham right now. You can see it yourself. What they're doing is bleeding us dry. The amount of fighters and resources that we have on the ground in Durham isn't enough to turn the tide against them. And until that tide turns against them, they're not going to empty out Coax County. Right now, Durham is an unfortunate insurgency, and they know they're going to win. We know it too. The fighters know it. And it's demoralizing. No one's seen any fresh faces around here in a week. All they see is their friends dying and no one new coming to pick up the banner."
She couldn't help a sneer from crawling across her face.
"It smells like defeat around here."
A calm female voice spoke, recorded, synthesized, devoid of any emotion. It was Jean's voice modulator.
"This vault," Jean said, "this office that you want to strike at, can you take this objective with what you have on hand?"
Carolyn looked at her mother's shriveled form and she hated her and loathed her and loved her. But her love was just pity. The sad knowing of some manufactured ideal that had never been, but you mourn its passing regardless.
"I've run the numbers,"
Carolyn said.
"And?"
Well now, what was the truth here? The truth was that it was possible to do the operation with what she had on hand. It simply wasn't likely to succeed.
"No,"
Carolyn finally said.
"I don't have anybody that can pull it off clean. I can throw people at it, but I don't just need more people.
She paused, waited for another question, but one didn't come, so she continued.
I need a better quality of people. So you've said,
the calm voice replied.
And your request for more and better fighters has been extended to our partners.
By which she meant Richard Honeycutt and Stephen Linklater, the leaders of the other two main factions of the Resistance.
If they have not sent you what you needed, perhaps you should take it up with them.
Carolyn pursed her lips, stuck now in a difficult spot. She could not get Honeycutt to commit more or better fighters because he knew that Durham was just a feint. But if she explained that to her parents, she would have to explain how he knew. And how he knew was because Carolyn had told him. Because they had a deal. A deal her parents didn't know about. And a deal that she intended to keep. Especially since it had just recently been fruitful. If it hadn't been for Honeycutt's network of safe houses, she would never have even had a place to send Walter when she found him. And since she had to assume that Walter was there, dear God, please let him have gotten there safely, that meant that she was still beholden to Honeycutt. Outing him was simply a card that she wasn't going to play. And on the other side of that, Mr. Linklater didn't know that Durham was a feint, but he followed Honeycutt's lead and figured that if Honeycutt didn't want to send better people, neither would he. Linklater figured that Honeycutt had a good reason for making that decision. And while Linklater was ultimately correct for this decision to copy Honeycutt, it made Carolyn despise him and view him as weak and incapable of calling his own shots. Carolyn drew in a breath.
If you want this job done correctly, and you want to truly engage the Coax, really do something that'll light their pants on fire and get them to empty out Coax County, then I need more than just more civilian fighters.
She swallowed. It was thick and pasty. She barreled forward.
I need a team of new breeds.
Benjamin made a dissatisfied noise. Carolyn cut him off before he could begin to argue.
I'm not asking you to send entire contingents down from West Virginia, she said. They can stay safe where they are and be prepared to take on Coax County when the time arises.
She realized that her clasped hands were in front of her chest, like she was begging, and she hated that.
You have teams of new breeds there in Kanawha 3, don't you? I'd only need one.
Stephanie. God damn that name.
I'd only need one team of new breeds, she insisted. It wouldn't even make a dent in your plans, and it would not only make this entire operation possible, but it would bolster the morale of the fighters that we already have here and let them know that the people in charge actually give a shit about them, and that they haven't just been left in this city to die by themselves.
Stephanie, Benjamin snapped. She bit off her words, flashed her teeth, hating the figures that hung in the air before her. Benjamin's image leaned forward. You wanted to prove yourself, he stated with cold factuality. You wanted to come to Durham to show us what you're made of. You killed poor John because he tried to stop you. You were so hell on fire to do it. But since you've arrived in Durham, all you've done is complain about need, need, need. Her father's brow beetled and his features darkened as he spoke, getting himself worked up. What do you think this is, Stephanie? Do you think this is an organized military that we're running here? Do you think we can draft people? Do you think we have a reserve of millions of troops and weapons and supplies just sitting around that we can call upon at a moment's notice? He slapped his hand down on a tabletop that was not in view of the monitor. No, you have to make do. Jean spoke up, infuriatingly calm, but she dialed the volume up on her modulator, the only method she had to display her disapproval.
You may not realize how we've had to build what we've had, but we've done it by being smart and being frugal. Not only with money and supplies, but with the lives of our people.
Carolyn almost screamed at her, thinking of the man in the kitchen when she had only been a child. The man they had convinced to suicide bomb the very place she was now trying to attack. Had they cared so much about his life?
Making do may not be a lesson that you've had to learn.
She thought about stretching every dollar just to make ends meet with Walter.
But you simply can't have everything you want when you want it.
Carolyn stared at the image of her mother.
It's one team.
One team that has already been accounted for, Benjamin broke in. Every bit of manpower that we have hiding in Kanawha 3 has been accounted for in our plans, and there's no room for error.
You're never going to get to put that plan into action if the Coax doesn't take the bait here. Why are you not seeing that?
Because I know for a fact that if you cannot pull off what we require in Durham, Benjamin said, glowering forward, filling up the monitor, then we have an eager pool of applicants for your job that are all quite positive that they can do more than you've done with less. And that is what we need right now. We need someone in charge of Durham who can do more with less. Can you do that, Stephanie? She grit her teeth. She jutted her chin. She bit down on her tongue. She said nothing. And then finally, she nodded. She said,
"Yes."
"Good," Benjamin said, leaning away from the monitor. "Then get it done, Stephanie. Time is of the essence, and your mother and I are not pleased with the progress there. You're right. The coax is kicking our asses, and there's only one person to blame." He pointed directly at the monitor, his eyes blazing. "You've got one more week, Stephanie. One more week before we pull you back to Coax County and put someone in as POC who can accomplish what we need accomplished." "That person doesn't exist," Carolyn raved in her mind. The only reason that they thought she was failing was because she was inexperienced. And when the player is inexperienced, then it is always their fault when they fail. It could not possibly be the overwhelming circumstances in which any person would have failed. She wanted to choke them both. But she nodded again, this time not trusting herself to speak even a single word. Benjamin considered her fuming countenance, and for a moment it seemed as though he might have more to say about it, but he just shook his head with exasperation, repeated his one-week deadline, and killed the monitor. Carolyn stood there staring at the blank projection for 10 solid beats of her heart, and she tried to get a handle on her temper. It was not like her to want to flip a table over, and yet the thought seemed very attractive for a moment.
"Excuse me."
Carolyn jerked up, looked to her right. A skinny young woman stood there. She couldn't have been more than 18. Carolyn recognized her as one of the usual techs that spent her time glued to one of the various monitors in the Fresh Market Command Center. She wore too much eye makeup and had a plethora of piercings all across her face.
"I'm sorry,"
Carolyn murmured, straightening up and feeling her cheeks flush.
"I didn't think anyone was here. I just walked in,"
the young woman said. Carolyn nodded, wondering how much she'd seen.
"So, can I help you?"
The woman, hardly more than a girl, really, stepped forward and held out a small paper bag, a hesitant smile on her lips.
Yes. Carmichael sent me to get these for you."
Carolyn stepped forward and took the bag. She looked in it. 2 more bottles of stims. Great. Carolyn crumpled the bag closed, reminded of how little sleep she had and how much work there was left to be done.
"Thanks,"
she stated.
"What's your name?"
"Jin,"
the young woman said with a self-conscious fidget.
"Ginny, actually. Ma'am. But everyone calls me Jin."
"Okay, Jin."
Carolyn offered a smile that felt forced.
"Thanks again."
"Oh, yeah."
Jin waved Carolyn off.
"It's no problem.
Carolyn waited, then felt it necessary to prompt the nervous young woman.
"Yes? I just wanted to say that I think you're doing great."
Carolyn stared at her. Jin shifted around.
"Well,"
Carolyn said, folding and refolding the paper bag,
"you might be the only one."
Before Jin could respond to this, Carolyn felt the need to disengage, and so she turned briskly and walked away. Chapter 16. "It's just your body," Roy told himself. He told himself this over and over and over. "It's just your body. It's just your body." Disassociation had long been his best method of compartmentalizing torture. It was how he had made it through DTI without losing his mind. But this time was different. This time was worse. To escape? To think that you were free of a nightmare and then to be forced back into it? It had broken something in him, he could tell. And he tried like hell not to think about that broken thing, and not to actually think that something was broken at all, because weakness could kill him. But he knew it. He knew it deep down inside, where things are known, whether you want to admit them or not. And they were doing it again, because Agent Goring was here. And he knew how to strip Roy down. He knew how to break him. He carved Roy up like a master chef filleting a fish. This was his business, and he knew it well. He knew Roy well. He knew how to bring him low. "It's just your body. It's just your body. It's just your body." They hadn't touched him. Hadn't beaten him, hadn't cut him, hadn't blared horrific music, specially synthesized to make your adrenal glands go haywire. They hadn't strapped him to a chair and poured water down his throat to make his body think he was drowning. They hadn't done any of those things. They'd just stuffed him in a hole. It was a square hole in the ground in a corner of the black site. It was concrete. The walls were straight, the surface rough and uncomfortable. It was not wide enough to lay down in. It was not tall enough to stand up in. It was only large enough to crouch there. Too cramped to adjust yourself, too cramped to fidget. In the cage above him poured in light, and if he looked up, he saw the rest of the facility, and he stared at those high ceilings like a man in the desert would look at a waterfall. He'd been here before. He'd been here in times that he had hoped were forever behind him, but which still managed to wake him up sweating out of a dead sleep, the reality of his dream so poignantly strong that sometimes his body would be racked with the same cramps that he felt now. It was the catalyst of a burgeoning insanity. He'd been reduced to an animal while he'd been in DTI, and he'd somehow convinced himself that all of that was behind him, that he'd become a whole person again. But being here in this hole yanked him back into that toxic mental space with such surprising quickness that it felt like this had only ever been his reality, and that his freedom had been just a passing dream. It brought him back to that low place like he'd never even left, and he could feel the pathetic, cringing baseness of it all coming back to him, and his humanity drifted away with his logic and reason. His brain was on fire. It's just your body. His muscles were in knots. It's just your body. And the second a cramp somewhere would power out and give him a half moment to be free of the pain, one would start somewhere else. Now in his quads, now in his hamstrings, now in his back. It's just your body. And sometimes the cramps would sit there, and then they would retreat just a bit and come back seemingly stronger than before. He was insane. He was mad with a desire to simply stand up, to extend his legs, or his arms, even just one arm, something. But he couldn't. He could barely move. It was like being wedged in a cave with untold metric tons of mountain and earth over top of you with no place to go, no way to get out of your situation, and no one that knew you were down in the dark. There was no rescue. You would be pinned there until you died. He hated the tight spaces. He hated them in the way that you hate what you fear the most. When he'd been free of them, just the thought of them, or the memory of them, of the hole that they'd crammed him into when he was in DTI, it would set his brain off like a string of fireworks. Panic and sickness and breathlessness and uncontrollable sweating. Claustrophobic. People that got uncomfortable in an elevator had no fucking idea what they were talking about. Roy would break his own leg off for a chance to be in an elevator. He would kill for the opportunity to move himself, because his body was screaming. It was screaming at him, and there was nothing he could do about it. Nothing at all, except to close his eyes and keep telling himself that it's just your body, and try with everything he had to see himself as a ghost that hovered above the pathetic, crumpled form of his physicality. That imagined freedom was the only way he kept himself from crying out, from begging for them to release him. Because once you begged, you broke. And once you broke, you talked. A finger stabbed into the muscles of his back, hooked his trapezius, and began to twist. He tried to shift, to relieve it, but the walls to either side were close, and they kept his shoulders scrunched together. He tried to angle himself so that his shoulders could take up the diagonal span between the corners, but the twisting only caused his abdominal muscles to ratchet down, and he gasped and tried to arch his back to stretch his stomach, but there wasn't enough room for that either. Something in him whispered that he was going to die. That's not true. That's not true. And he tried again to disassociate himself, but the pain was so real, so tangible, so present that he could not separate it from him. It wrapped around him like strong, hard tentacles and constricted him, pulled him back into himself. His heart thundered. Can your heart cramp? Please, he whispered to himself, or to someone, even though he did not want them to hear him, because it tricked his mind into thinking there might be an end in sight, and so it eased the panic to the point that he could breathe. These were the games that you had to play. This was the insanity he'd survived in DTI. Please, he whispered again, trying to revel in the small victory that that one word provided him, because you had to accept your wins. You had to hold them close. You had to ascribe infinite value to the most trivial thing because you had nothing else. Like the bit of shoe when he'd been in DTI. The bit of rubber from the sandal. It had come off, and they'd taken the sandals to the trash, but they hadn't seen that little thumb-sized piece of rubber that had come off. And Roy had taken it, and he'd hid it. Sometimes he hid it under his cot. Sometimes he hid it in his mouth if he knew that they were tossing cells that day. Because it was his. He had nothing else in DTI. Just a piece of old shoe rubber. And because it was a game he could play. It was a way to distract himself. It was a way to find purpose. A way to be proud of himself. Proud because he had something that no one else had. And proud because he was smart enough to keep it a secret so that no one knew about his piece of shoe rubber. He'd never told anybody about it. Madness. Insanity. You're slipping. Slipping down. Like reality was a scree slope and he was sliding down it, unable to get a handhold in all the looseness, and it was only avalanching him down, back into the abyss, and he had thought he'd never be that low again, but here he was. Here I am. He would have gladly died in that moment. If he'd seen a gun, he would not have used it to fight. He would have blown his brains out with it. The things they do. He whimpered to no one and anyone, because again, it shaved a percentage point from his misery. The things they do, the things they do. And he went on, repeating that for a while, and sometimes gagging on his own words as a new cramp struck him, or an old one, stronger than before. Roy! A voice called out from above him. No, no, no. The voice made him tense up even more, sparked off the knot in his back and shoulder. It felt like it was going to pull him apart. He gritted his teeth together. It's only your body. Roy, the voice said again, cajoling. Look at me. Games. It was all a big fucking game, and Roy didn't have the energy to play it. He fought through a kink in his neck and tilted his head up, hoping to God for a reprieve, and at the same time dreading it because it would lead to failure. He was looking up through the grate that kept him hunched low in this impossible space. Agent Goring was crouching there above his head, looking down at him. The agent's expression was soft, almost one of pity.
Do you want out? Goring asked.
Roy stared at him. His body shook all over. He bit down on his tongue. Goring wiped at his face, then perched a finger there, regarding the man in the hole with a look of regret. Roy felt himself subconsciously reaching for that pity, drawn in by it. He tried to resist, but it was hard. It was hard to be mentally strong when all your faculties were focused on simply not breaking. So much of him was going into controlling the pain so that he didn't scream out, didn't start thrashing violently in the tiny space, didn't start begging pitifully for them to release him. Because once you begged, you broke. Goring shook his head.
Roy, just ask, he implored. That's all you gotta do. I have to hear you ask me, okay? That's it.
It's a stupid rule, I know, but that's how it is. Roy wasn't aware of any rules when it came to this. He was almost certain that there weren't any. Here in this black site, just as in DTI, it was hell and Goring was Satan. He ruled this underworld, and what he said was what happened. He answered to no one. Logical thought, far away and muted. Animal feeling, a massive, surging desire to be free. Because what Goring said provided an endpoint to the misery, to the torture, to the tiny space that was going to drive him mad and break him. That endpoint dangled out there, and the price to pay for it did not seem so much. All he had to do was ask. Just ask.
Just ask me, Goring said, as though perceiving Roy's struggle. Just say, please let me out.
No, no, no. It's a game. It was a game, and this was the opening move. This wasn't the checkmate. This was the first movement of a pawn. This was the setup. But it would lead to a checkmate, sure as shit. Roy had gone down this road before. He knew it. But Goring knew something, too. He knew that even though Roy was familiar with the strategy, one could only deny their animal nature for so long. Panic was a powerful force. Fear compelled people beyond their rational brains. A man can know logically that he will not actually drown while being waterboarded, but that doesn't mean he won't break under that sensation. What a man logically knows had nothing to do with it. That's what Goring knew.
Just say, please let me out, Goring pressed, and we'll get you out of that hole.
Let you stretch your legs, sit at a table, or lie on the ground if that's what you want.
You can have it. You just have to ask.
Goring sighed.
Don't be such a stubborn fuck. He hissed. I'm trying to help you.
He's not. It's only my body. Roy screamed in his mind, and then he screamed from his mouth. Screamed long, painful, powerful, and it cramped his abdominal muscles again, but that didn't stop the shrieking. He thrashed in the space, the panic to be out of it now growing far beyond anything that he could control, and he wanted simply to break out of it, even though he knew it was impossible to break those poured concrete walls, but he thrashed so hard against them anyways. And above him, Goring just stared and gave no reaction at all to this.
Please!
Roy yelled. And that was it. It was out of his mouth. It could not be taken back. The effect was instantaneous. Goring may have already had the cage unlocked and unlatched, because the second the word came out of Roy's mouth, the cage opened and two soldiers reached in, hooked their fingers under Roy's armpits, and dragged him out. He felt himself leaving the hole. And goddamn his brain. He looked at those soldiers, and he looked at that agent, and for a moment, in his gargantuan slurry of relief, they were angels sent to rescue him. Lies. Games. But he wept like he'd found his way home. They laid him on the ground, his body locked into a half-fetal position by the twisting, seizing muscles, like rigor mortis had already set in. He rolled onto his back, then onto his side again. He wallowed in the revelry of this simple movement, and he wept. He extended his legs, and the muscles cramped at this, too, but it was better, because at least they were extended. At least he could move his legs to alleviate the pain. Gradually, his body started to loosen. The rigor mortis was leaving him. Joints wailed, muscles turned to slag. "That's it," Goring said as he stood there, watching Roy stretch in slow agony. "Try to relax." "Please," Roy whispered, almost too quiet to be heard. "Please." And in his stomach, a great dark dread grew, and just at that moment it overtook the animal relief, because the pain was starting to quiet down to a level that he could perceive past, and what came next was a dark black hole that he knew to be fear.
"Please."
Goring patted his shoulder. "All right." Goring straightened and wiped his hand off on his pants. "Put him back in."
"No!"
Roy wasn't even a human anymore. He had no dignity left. He begged. He screeched. He tried to fight them. But he didn't have the strength. His body would not cooperate. The two angels turned to demons again, and they shoved him back in that hole, and they stuffed him down again so his knees scraped against the rough concrete and his shoulders were compressed and his groin muscle cramped and then his hamstring, and he begged and begged and begged, but no one would listen to him. The cage crashed down over his head. It was locked and latched. Roy stared up at it, weeping openly. He kept saying please, but that wasn't good enough now. Goring stood over him, staring down, smiling and shaking his head. "They're always easier the second time around," he said, self-satisfied. Then he bent down. "If you don't want to die in that stinking hole smeared with your own piss and shit, you tell me how they killed my new breeds in that ambush. You tell me what sort of weapon they used, and maybe I'll let you out."
He stood up and he walked away. Roy was left in the hole in the ground, screaming after him. He promised to talk. He promised to tell. "When you beg, you broke." But none of that was good enough, and Roy knew that now they would leave him for a very long time. He would be in the hole much longer than he already had.
"I can't do this!"
And once that thought had been given a voice, once it had been acknowledged, there was no going back. Chapter 17.
"Someone's coming." Walter came upright. Those were the magic words to break into the haziest blanket of exhaustion that he could remember being under in a very long time. Had he been sleeping? He was on the couch in the living room of the safe house. The couch, with its predominantly green fabric, covered in impressionistic images of guys on horseback and dogs running alongside. Some sort of old-timey fox hunt or something. It took him a moment of confusion to place the environs. His brain was still so whacked out on fatigue. He stared with suspicious eyes at the old man standing in front of him. Old man. Pete. Pete the old man. Right.
"Who's coming?"
he slurred, leaning forward, his fuzzy head feeling faint for a moment. He blinked rapidly, rubbed his face.
"Where is everybody?"
he suddenly blurted, and for no reason at all, his heart started up again.
"Do we need to go? Fuck."
"Easy," Pete said, holding up a grizzled old paw. Walter stared at it.
"Okay, easy. I think it's your friends," Pete said, "but we need to make sure."
He nodded towards the front of the house.
"They just turned onto the drive. You need to call them."
"Call them?"
"Yes," Pete replied, already turning away, turning towards the dining room, the table, the sniper rifle sitting on top of it. "Call them," Pete repeated as he pulled a chair out for himself and sat down behind the rifle with practiced deliberateness. He flipped up the scope covers, then looked at Walter over the buttstock.
"Anytime soon would be good."
Walter tried to focus through his swimming head.
I don't have comms with them. The other guy...
He realized that this was his problem, regardless of whether he had communication with the newcomers. He stood up with a swear.
Gibbs! Gibbs, we need you!
Gibbs ripped his way out of the spare bedroom with his battle rifle in his hand.
What? What's wrong?
At the dining room table, Pete the old man settled into his scope. Walter gestured towards him.
You gotta call Kaz before this maniac shoots them.
Shit. Gibbs flipped up his PD and stabbed a few selections out of the air.
Pete, hold your fire.
Tell them to stop, Pete droned, closing his left eye and sighting through his right. Someone on the other end of the line answered.
Stop the car, Gibbs ordered. Stop where you are.
Walter stood there in the living room, buzzing. He knew that Pete was concerned about safety, but Jesus.
They're stopped, Pete said. Then he frowned. I'm counting four people in that car. Why is there four? No one said anything about four people.
All right, Gibbs responded, placating.
Let me ask. I'm sure there's a reasonable explanation.
I can see you two new breeds, Pete went on, like he hadn't even heard Gibbs. But then there's two normies in there, too. Who are the normies?
Kaz, who are the two people you got in the car with you?
A pause as Gibbs listened.
He says one is the doctor and the other is...
the boyfriend of the doctor. Gibbs frowned at the monitor. Pete didn't look over. He sucked his teeth.
The boyfriend, he mumbled. The fuck's he doing here is what I want to know.
Gibbs relayed the question. By now, the rest of the new breeds had exited out of the spare bedroom where they'd set up their little command hub and stood around watching this all go down with a sort of ready tension, as though they wished something exciting would happen. Getty also appeared from the kitchen eating a sandwich.
What's going on?
He asked around a mouthful. Walter nodded towards Gibbs by way of explanation.
They say the boyfriend had to come with them, Gibbs said to Pete. It was a liability to leave him behind.
Pete, still not taking his eyes from the scope.
So they're worried about him tattling?
Gibbs bobbled his head.
I guess.
So he's a fucking rat.
Apparently.
And they brought him here.
Gibbs didn't respond. Pete chuffed.
Nah. No rats in this house.
Pete, we need that doctor, Gibbs said. And what do you want them to do with the boyfriend? Kick him out right here on your property?
Shoot him,
Pete said, as though it was an elementary math problem. Gibbs, with surprising apathy, simply turned to the monitor and said,
Kaz, shoot the boyfriend.
There was a whole second where everyone in the room just stood there, bracing themselves, maybe for a gunshot, or maybe for Gibbs to simply nod to Pete and tell him it had been done, or perhaps Pete would see it for himself through his scope and simply tell them they were clear to come on. And then Walter heard screaming. Distant screaming. Gibbs winced and touched the tiny implant on his ear that projected that noise right into his ear canal. It was the people in the car. Then the screaming died down. At the table, Pete grumbled at whatever he saw.
All right, Gibbs said finally. The doctor says she won't help if they shoot her boyfriend.
Well, Pete drawled, I guess we got a bit of a problem then.
Walter turned to the old man at the table.
Pete, we need that doctor.
I need a house with no rats in it.
Walter shook his head. That ship has sailed. You're gonna have to make a compromise.
I don't have to compromise shit.
What are you gonna do? Fire on them?
Walter asked.
The second you try to fire on their friends, those four new breeds are gonna rip you to shreds, old man.
For the first time, Pete pulled his gaze away from the rifle scope and calmly assessed the four new breeds gathered in the living room only 15 or 20 feet from him. Gibbs wasn't the only one with a battle rifle in his hands, and they were all nodding slowly, assenting to what Walter had said.
Besides, Walter pressed, it makes the most sense to pull him in. The boyfriend, I mean. We can't let him go, that's for sure. So the best bet is to keep him close. Hell, once they get in here, you can tie him up and leave him in a closet for all we give a shit. We just need the doctor to treat Bobby. But you're gonna have to compromise, because you can't shoot at the vehicle, and you can't let it go either.
At the entrance to the kitchen, only about a foot or two away from the path of Pete's muzzle, Getty laid his sandwich down on the paper plate he carried, and he very purposefully sauntered in front of the muzzle, and then around it, and laid the paper plate down on the dining room table. Pete looked up at Getty. They held each other's gazes. Getty sucked a bit of something out of his teeth and nodded.
Listen to him.
Pete grunted, but didn't release his grip on the rifle yet.
This isn't us versus you, Walter said. Everyone is unhappy right now. And that's the best compromise, right? When everybody is unhappy?
Pete smacked his lips a few times, his hound dog eyes going between Walter and then Getty, and occasionally over to Gibbs.
Right, then. Suppose there's some logic to what you say. I'll let them in on the condition that the boyfriend is blindfolded and bound and kept in a secure location and monitored at all times while he's here. Secondly, once the doctor's done curing your friend Bobby, I want him taken care of.
Taken care of? Walter questioned. Pete looked at him like he was a particularly dull student.
Yeah, fucking taken care of.
You gotta win, Walter told himself as he took in a breath. Just say okay and figure out the rest later. Walter nodded.
Okay, deal.
The reunion of Kaz and Javon with their team was short and violent. It was something like watching a scrum of grizzly bears fight, except they weren't actually trying to hurt each other. It was loud and rough, and there was a profusion of questions from both sides, and Walter didn't think anyone got an answer. There was concern for Javon, but once he assured them he was fine, it turned to jibes about his future robot arm. This occurred in the kitchen at the door to the garage. The door still hung open, and Walter felt the warm air from outside flowing in. He stood on the opposite end of the kitchen. Between him was a short, pretty woman and a gangly, scared-looking man. Walter exchanged a glance with Getty, and Getty nodded. Behind them both, Pete stood waiting for his requests to be met. Getty stepped to the gangly man. Walter stepped to the woman. She had a polymer case that was slung by a shoulder strap and looked like it might just contain some helpful medical equipment.
Ma'am, Walter said, just loud enough to be heard over the new breeds in the background. My name is Walter. You must be the doctor.
The woman blinked a few times. Her lips curled.
I'm a veterinarian.
Walter raised an eyebrow.
Well, we'll take what we can get.
What's your name? She considered this for a moment.
Macy.
Beside them, Getty had skillfully guided the gangly man off to the side and was currently having him put his hands behind his back.
Why?
The gangly man demanded, even as he obeyed.
Because we need to restrain you, Getty replied, for our safety.
Hey!
Macy said, turning away from Walter.
What's going on? You don't need to restrain him.
Getty tightened a zip tie around the man's wrists. Pete stepped forward, planted his implacable hound dog self between Macy and her boyfriend.
Yes, he does.
Who the fuck are you?
Macy demanded.
I own this place, Pete replied, and I say he gets restrained, and blindfolded, and secured in a small room.
The man looked over his shoulder, his eyes wide.
What? What did you say?
Getty had a dark green pillowcase which he slid over the man's head.
Don't get squirrely, brother. Just go along with it, okay?
Macy started to bluster, her pale cheeks flushing.
Macy, Walter tried and gently took hold of her elbow.
She ripped her arm away from him.
You can't do this! Kaz, you son of a bitch!
Walter felt a grim little line of anger shoot through him like a piece of shrapnel. He grabbed her elbow again, this time hard enough that she couldn't shake him off, and he spun her around to face him. She reared back, her teeth bared like an animal, and she balled her fists up and was about to make a go of Walter's face. He seized her by the wrists and held her there, hard enough that she couldn't get free of him. The anger was sudden and reason-free, and it expelled all propriety from Walter. Just for a moment, he was willing to break her thin wrists if he needed to. Bobby was in the other room and needed help. That was more important than Macy's mental comfort.
Stop, he growled at her. Stop it.
She stopped. Looked up at him. Defiant, but with a note of fear.
He's not your problem right now. Right now, your problem is a woman named Bobby. She needs help. You're gonna help her. That's not a request.
Macy stared at Walter, and Walter stared back at her. The room had gone quiet. Over her shoulders, Walter saw that the new breeds watched with interest. Getty led the gangly man out of the room amid a flurry of mumbled protests. Walter thought that she might play the or what card. And he was already primed and loaded and ready to tell her all about the or what. But Macy didn't ask that question. She relaxed her body, and Walter relaxed his grip, but didn't let go. She loosened her balled-up hands, showing the palms to Walter.
All right. You can let go of me now.
Walter held on to her for another second, and he wasn't sure why. He felt shame creeping in on him like scalding water. It flushed his face, and he didn't want her to see it, so he let go and turned away.
Jesus, help me. Something is wrong with me.
Walter looked at Pete.
Would you mind showing Macy to Bobby's room?
Pete gave Walter a scrutinizing look that Walter didn't care for. Then he nodded and addressed himself to Macy.
Follow me.
In the living room, Walter sat on the couch. The reunited team of new breeds had gathered around him. Pete was in the kitchen cooking dinner, a giant mess of chili, according to the cook. Getty was in the bedroom with Bobby while Macy ran a few diagnostics.
Where's Roy? Kaz asked.
Walter shook his head, probed at the puckered line in the top of his hand where he'd been hit by shrapnel. It was still scabby where Doc Sheila had cauterized the flesh back together. Didn't hurt much, though.
Your guess is as good as mine. I haven't seen hide nor hair of him since we left that compound in Durham 2 weeks ago.
Kaz looked troubled.
I don't like that.
Walter agreed.
Me neither.
Kaz gave a quick rundown of the last 2 weeks, hiding out in Macy's apartment, waiting for Javon to heal up enough to move, and also waiting for a chance to use someone's PD to contact Gibbs. Luckily, the little gangly boyfriend had stumbled into their lives that very morning and provided a golden opportunity.
What have you been doing since the raid?
Kaz asked.
Fighting, Walter answered. We've been in Durham fighting. We hooked up with a group. Their leader was one of the prisoners we freed during the raid.
Walter's jaw muscles bunched. He thought about telling them everything that happened with Mel, but it was too much, and it didn't seem necessary.
Our home base got hit this morning by the coax, Walter concluded.
Javon was absently rubbing the stump of his missing arm, watching Walter.
Did you ever find your pops?
Walter stared at him. He felt it again. It rose up in him like it had on the back porch smoking a cigarette with Getty. Except for this time, it wasn't vomit that his body pushed out of him. This time, his throat began to ache dully, and he felt heat behind his eyes, and he found himself blinking rapidly and not able to speak for a moment.
Yeah,
Walter finally muttered. Javon simply nodded and raised a hand to prevent Walter from going on.
Enough said.
Walter nodded back, grateful. Gibbs cleared his throat, drawing attention to him. He leaned forward, putting his elbows on his knees. His battle rifle was propped against the arm of the couch to his right. He nodded to Kaz.
With you back in play here, I'd like to defer authority, if you're willing to take it.
Kaz rubbed his big red beard.
Yeah, I'm ready.
Gibbs gave him a slight bow of the head. Kaz returned it, an odd little changing of the guard ceremony.
Your boy here, Gibbs said, casting a thumb at Walter, basically made us sign over our firstborn children to get access to this safe house.
Walter quirked an eyebrow at the new breed sitting next to him, but the uptick of Gibbs's mouth told him that Gibbs was merely jabbing at him. Walter raised innocent hands.
I simply told them that if they wanted to come hang out in this nice, safe place, they'd have to play by my rules.
Kaz gave him a facial shrug.
Sure, sure. Sounds reasonable.
He looked around.
How'd you come across this place, anyhow?
Walter looked at him, gauging where Kaz was coming from, but it seemed like he was just trying to get his bearings.
My wife sent us here.
Your wife?
Yeah.
The Yudi one?
That's the one.
Shit.
Gibbs tilted his head.
What?
Kaz shifted, leaning on the back of the chair, looking at Walt like he had said something surprisingly dumb.
The Yudis are the ones that set us up, Walt.
I realize that.
Kaz's dark red eyebrows remained high in question. Walter rubbed his face wearily.
It's very complicated, Kaz.
Oh, I'm sure it is.
Look, his eyebrows descended and he gave Walter a discerning frown.
I don't need every dirty detail, okay? I'm gonna trust you to shoot straight with me. So shoot straight with me. Are we safe here?
Walter couldn't help but snort.
Are we safe anywhere, Kaz?
He shook his head and grunted to himself.
The Yudis want me dead more than they want you dead. In fact, they probably don't want you dead at all. You're a team of new breeds. They need you. Me? I'm just a fucking grower who lost his wife. I just complicate things for them.
He sighed heavily.
What I'm saying is that I'm in a hell of a lot more trouble than you are. So if I figure a place is safe for myself, it's probably pretty safe for you.
Kaz considered this at length and eventually nodded his head.
I'll accept that. Are we to assume that means that your wife... What's her name again?
Carolyn.
Are we to assume that Carolyn is not going to give you up to the Udies?
Walter clasped his hands together.
Yes, that is correct.
All right, then. Kaz partially relaxed. My next question to you is, what's next?
Next? We wait.
For?
For a call.
From?
Walter sighed.
Carolyn.
Kaz evaluated this, taking a moment to gaze up at the light fixtures.
So, she's a bit deeper in this than we thought.
Walter didn't answer. As it turned out, they didn't have long to wait.
Chapter 18.
Carolyn was a ball of nerves as she waited for the line to connect, and she wasn't sure why. There was a sort of excitement there, a sort of longing. She wanted to speak to Walter. She wanted to hear his voice. But at the same time, she was somehow afraid, and not sure what she was afraid of. Perhaps she was afraid that this call would be just like the short, hurried conversation on the steps of the hideout only minutes before it was attacked. Maybe she was afraid it was going to be all business. Maybe she was afraid that it had been too easy for them to be all business last time. Too easy for them to come together after weeks of not knowing whether the other was even alive and then separate moments later, going about the business of surviving. Their connection just a dull ache in the back of her brain that was too easy to ignore.
You love him, she told herself.
She decided.
War can't change that.
The light buzzing of the wait to connect tone ceased and she heard the line open up. She heard some background voices, but they stopped almost immediately. And then Walter's voice. Slow. Cautious.
Hello?
Carolyn closed her eyes.
It's me,
she said. She opened her eyes. She was in the passenger seat of a car. The car was parked in the mid-level of a parking garage. She could see out across the city from there. It was dark. Night had fallen, but the stars weren't out. The stars couldn't get out from behind the smoke screen of war-torn Durham. There was only the haze of pinkish light from the street lamps, but they were on the other side of town. Here in the red zone, the coax had cut the power. She glanced to her left. Brad Hughes sat in the driver's seat. He met her gaze, then quickly looked away, like he felt he was intruding on a private conversation.
Hey,
Walter said. There was a softness there. The caution gone, or at least soothed.
Are you alone?
Carolyn asked, touching her left eyebrow with one finger. A pause.
No, not exactly. Can you talk?
Yes, Walter said. The people I'm with can be trusted.
Good.
She breathed and was surprised to find that it shook.
Are you safe?
Yes. We're at the place you sent us to. What about you? Are you okay? It was the first sign of tenderness from her husband since she'd found out that he was still alive. And even something so slight as that both struck her hard and elevated her all at once. She closed her eyes again and pinched the bridge of her nose.
Yes.
Her voice thickened.
I'm okay. We got out of there in time. Did your friends make it?
Yes, they're with us. The woman was injured in a blast, but we have someone working with her. And there are a few others with us, too. She sensed that he was hesitant to tell her who they were. She decided not to press it.
Honey,
he corrected himself. What do we do next?
I'm trying to figure that out,
Carolyn admitted. Is there anything I can do to help?
Probably not.
Carolyn laughed bitterly.
This city is fucked. We're in up to our necks, and the coax isn't going to let us walk away. They're bleeding us dry.
Why the hell are we even in that city to begin with? Walter demanded, taking his cue from Carolyn to use vague speech. What's the fucking point? Carolyn stared at her feet for a moment, then looked up at the cityscape, unsure of where she stood on this, and finally she looked to her left, to Brad. She didn't have the call on speaker. It was on private, for her ears only. But they'd already talked about this before they even drove out to the parking garage for a private conference and a call to Walter. He seemed to know what she was struggling with, and he gave her a nod of encouragement.
I'm going to tell you some things that you're not supposed to know.
A pause. Okay.
You need to promise me that this information doesn't get out, and make sure that this call is on private, okay?
There was some shuffling on the line. The sound of the background noise changed.
Okay, you're on private.
She worked her jaw, focused. She wanted to tell him about Durham being a feint. She wanted to tell him that Coax County was the real target, but none of that could be said over a line like this. It was a secure line, but secure was a relative term, and with enough effort, secure could be made to be unsecure. It was best not to talk about things like that now, things that could make or break the resistance.
Listen,
she said, deciding that half-truths and things that the Coax already knew about could not hurt.
The Coax is trying to push a troop surge. It's in the works. It's just receiving a lot of disdain from the international community. Right now, we're at a tipping point here in Durham. If we can succeed, we can energize enough grassroots support to make the international community very uncomfortable with supporting a Sino-Russian troop surge.
Okay, Walter said. What do we need to do?
There's a target,
Carolyn said, choosing her words like the interpreter for a particularly dicey diplomatic situation.
There's a target we want that we think will give us the break that we need. Unfortunately, I'm having a hard time finding volunteers.
White lies. A pause on the other end of the line. So you need me and my people, Walter said, and he said it almost with an eagerness, with a spark of conspirators. And she loved it. She relaxed into it.
Yes, well,
she huffed.
I need some help, but not just bodies, Walter. I need real soldiers. I need good quality fighters.
On the other end of the line, Walter took an audible breath and let it out. I may be able to help. I have some folks here with us. Some good quality folks. Carolyn frowned in the dark.
What kind of quality?
Another slight pause. Do you remember the Rocky River Bridge? She sat blankly for a moment. Her finger began rubbing her eyebrow again.
Yes. Yes, I remember.
You remember going down there when we were kids?
Yes.
And you remember when we threw rocks? Carolyn swallowed, felt a thread of something that felt so like hope that she didn't want to admit it was there.
We threw the rocks at those three big columns, the big cement pylons that held the bridge up.
Yeah, Walter said. You remember what we imagined that they were? Carolyn realized that a half-smile had formed on her face. Her heart pumped hard.
We need to meet,
Carolyn said. Come to this place.
I'll be there in the morning.
And with a suddenness that she later regretted, Carolyn disconnected the line and sat there in the car, buzzing from head to foot, nearly twitching with possibilities. Brad noticed and leaned towards her. What? What did he say? Carolyn looked at the ex-agent sitting beside her.
I think they have new breeds.
Kaz had started on his third bowl of chili by the time Walter hung up. Pete the old man was very right to make a mess of chili. Anything less would have been inadequate. Kaz stood at the edge of the kitchen counter with his bowl in his hand and blew the steam away as he watched Walter staring off into space for a few moments. Well, Kaz said between breaths, how did it go? Walter looked up at Kaz and then shifted his gaze to the rest of the new breeds, who were scattered about the kitchen and dining room, all of them splitting their attention between the first adequate meal they'd had in a while and the man who could tell them what was next. She has something for us, Walter said. She's coming here in the morning, to meet in person. What sort of thing does she have? Walter shook his head. She didn't want to say over the line. She said it was a target, but she couldn't get access to a group of fighters that could hit it. Walter twirled his finger in the air. I'm extrapolating here based on what she said. What was all that under-the-bridge talk? Kaz said with a quirk of his eyebrow. Walter looked up at him like his thoughts were far and away. He blinked a few times and then looked down at the carpet. Just an inside thing. Kaz nodded, didn't push it anymore. But she knows that we're here. Walter stood up, looked about like he'd forgotten what he'd stood up for. Yeah, I think so. The door to Bobby's bedroom opened and Macy came out, followed by Getty, who closed the door behind her. Macy and Getty walked up to Walter, and the three of them spoke in confidential tones. How's it looking? Walter asked. Macy nodded.
She'll be okay in a bit. I don't think the TBI was bad enough to warrant any sort of surgical correction, which is good because I don't have the resources for that. I put her on some intravenous drugs that'll stabilize and start correcting any damaged cells, and also to level her mood out. It's not unusual that someone be a little edgy after a TBI.
Walter smoothed his goatee. He nodded. Okay. How long until she's back to normal? Macy shrugged. Kaz noted that she looked very tired.
I don't know. Normal is a relative term. She might experience migraines for months, even years. Occasional mood swings. Or maybe none of that. Maybe she'll be fine tomorrow. There's no telling with the brain.
Walter pursed his lips, considering this. Then he finally bowed his head to Macy.
Thank you. For everything. For helping Kaz and Javon. And for helping Bobby.
Macy eyed him.
Yeah, sure. Who's in charge here? Is it you?
She looked over at Kaz.
Or him.
Walter rubbed his chin. Depends on what you need. Macy put her hands on her hips.
I need to get James and get the hell out of here.
Kaz put his bowl of chili down and did a quick scan of the room. He didn't see Pete anywhere. Perhaps the old fucker had retired for the evening. One could only hope.
Walt, Kaz said, let me talk to you outside.
Macy made as though to follow them to the back door. Kaz turned towards her and held up a large paw.
Give us a sec, will you?
Macy glared.
Let the men talk?
Kaz rolled his eyes.
Don't bust my balls here, Macy. I'm trying to help.
On the back patio, Kaz closed the door behind him. It was full dark. The stars were overhead. The light from the dining room and living room turned the windows a bright yellow and lit the patio in a stark contrast of angled light. A few low-power solar lights stood like bioluminescent mushrooms at the perimeter of the cement.
Where's Pete?
Walter asked, his voice low. Kaz shrugged.
Haven't seen him since he made the chili.
Walter looked inside the house from the back windows. His face was heavily lined with shadows. He looked sunken. The scarred half of his face was mottled by the darkness.
I'm not gonna kill him, Walter said.
Kaz sniffed.
I can.
Walter actually smiled, let out a little laugh.
Yeah, I figured you could, but that's not what I meant.
He looked Kaz in the eye and his face grew serious again.
I mean that we are not gonna kill him.
Breaking your word to Pete.
Killing him is breaking my word to Macy.
Kaz made a non-committal noise.
You didn't really promise, Macy.
We're not gonna kill him.
Well, Pete'll be pissed.
Fine, then he gets pissed. But executing that sad fuck is...
Walter shook his head and his lips tightened.
It's too much.
Kaz stared down at the man in front of him and he knew what Walter felt. He remembered feeling the same way back in the day when he felt things like that. Not to say that a new breed was devoid of emotion, because they weren't. But the manipulation of one's genetic code in order to become a super soldier caused changes in more than just the body. Kaz remembered his life before the modifications, his life as a normal human being, and he remembered feeling things that he recalled now with a sort of distant eye. The way you remember things hazily from when you were a very young child, or perhaps from when you were very drunk. But that old, lost version of himself identified with Walter in that moment. He knew what Walter was feeling. Walter was feeling stretched. Walter was feeling the hugeness of the task at hand and how there never seemed to be enough of himself to cover it. And if he kept stretching himself, then he was going to tear. He was going to break. Walter feared a break. And a break wouldn't do anybody any good right now. So if Walter needed to let the slimy little shitbag live in order to stave off that break, then Kaz wouldn't tell him no. Kaz's own modified brain chemistry had already taken James out of the neutral category where the vast majority of people stayed. It was a place where Kaz really didn't care what became of you, and had him firmly in the enemy category, a place where Kaz actively thought of ways to eliminate your existence. But Walter here had somehow made it into Kaz's friend category, and that meant that Kaz was mostly willing to do anything for him, even if it meant letting James live. Kaz smiled beneath his beard as he realized this.
What are you smiling about? Walter asked.
Kaz put a big hand on Walter's shoulder and squeezed it.
Well, shit. I guess I consider you a friend. So fine. If you want the sack of shit to live, then we can make that happen.
Walter was confused, but shared the smile with Kaz for a few moments.
What about Pete? Kaz asked.
Walter nodded.
You let me worry about Pete. You get Macy and her boyfriend out of here. Alive.
James wasn't sure how he did it, but he had somehow fallen asleep. Well, more of a doze, really. He'd spent about 10 minutes wriggling around in his restraints before figuring that they were impossible to defeat, and then he'd simply lay still. The panic had come on again, and he felt like he was crammed into a small box and the walls were closing in. He was actually crammed into a closet, but the walls were staying right where they were. It just felt like the space was getting smaller because he kept thinking that there was no way out, and he kept thinking that that bastard with the red beard had used his PD to contact some illicit number, and he kept thinking that the Fed was tracking him down, and if only he could tell them that it was all a misunderstanding.